This meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee will come to order. The time is 3:17 p.m. on Monday, February 16th. Members present are Representative Carrick, Representative Coulombe, Representative Sadler, Representative Nelson, Co-Chair Fields, and myself, Co-Chair Hall. We have a quorum. Please silence all cell phones. We're asking that staff and members of the audience not approach the table. If you need to pass a note to committee members, please get the attention of my committee aide, Joan Wilkerson, and she will take care of it. I'd like to thank Andrew Magnuson, the Labor and Commerce Committee Secretary, and Jude Augustine from the Juneau LAO for tech and teleconferencing support. Today we have one bill and one presentation on the agenda. The bill is HB 195, Pharmacists Prescription Authority, and the president is about non-resident workers in Alaska. HB 195, Pharmacists Prescription Authority, sponsored by Representative Genevieve Mina, was heard by this committee on February 11th. Today, we will consider one amendment, and we will take public testimony. The deadline for amendments was 10 a.m. on Friday, February 14th. The committee received two amendments, but amendment number one is not going to be offered at this time, so members should be able to find amendment number two in their packets. Amendment number two is offered by myself, Co-Chair Hall, for consideration, and with that, I will move amendment number two.
Object.
Representative Fields, thank you for objecting for the purposes of discussion. With that, I'd like to call up the bill sponsor, Representative Mina, and her aide, Katie Giorgio, to explain the amendment before the committee. In addition, we also have Dr. Brandy Sinemartin and Dr. Ashley Schaber available by phone for committee questions.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hall and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, Genevieve Mina. I represent House District 19, the Anchorage neighborhoods of Airport Heights, Mountain View, and Russian Jack. And I will have my staff, Katie Giorgio, give an overview of the amendment.
Thank you, Katie Giorgio. For the record, amendment N.2 was brought to us by our good friends at DCCED, and it is clarifying language around the time frame in which a pharmacist, if they do choose to pursue continuing education credits for the pain management part of this bill, it just sort of shifts the way that we were talking about that time frame. So it coincides with how pharmacists sort of report on other continuing education credits that they've earned. So the language just changes it so it's in line with other continuing education statutes.
Thank you, Ms. Giorgio. Are there any questions from the committee? Seeing none, Representative Fields, do you maintain your objection?
I do not.
Okay. With that, and not hearing or seeing any other objection, Amendment N.2 is adopted. Are there any other additional questions or comments from committee members regarding this bill at this time? Seeing none, next we will transition to public testimony. Given the number of callers on the line and the other matters on the committee's agenda today, each caller, everyone who's providing public testimony on HB 195, will be given a strict 2 minutes to testify. Testimony can also be offered through email to the committee at house.labor.and.commerce@akleg.gov. Additionally, the committee will hear public testimony on HB 195 until 4:15 p.m. That is a strict cutoff due to the presentation that the committee has before it on outside workers in Alaska. So with that, I will open public testimony. Is there anybody in the room who'd like to testify on HB 195? Seeing none, we will transition to online. Looks like we will be starting with Jeanette Seal. From Anchorage. Jeanette is not available. So we will be transitioning to Jessica Wagner calling from Fairbanks. Ms. Wagner, if you could please introduce yourself, put your name on the record, and begin your 2 minutes of public testimony.
Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Jessica Wagner. I'm a Fairbanks resident. Thank you for the time and hearing my testimony. When I'm picking up my prescriptions, I never want to talk to the pharmacist or ask them questions. Do you? Not only do I feel uncomfortable talking to them about personal matters, there's no privacy. My physician is the only one I feel comfortable and safe taking medical advice from. So I think this bill in general is not in the best interest for anyone, even the pharmacist. I'm wondering if they're going to be covered for the likely lawsuits ahead. I'm concerned about this bill in general, but we'll focus on the fact that the House bill does not have the same amendment that the Senate bill does for medical abortions. Medical abortion should not be treated so flippantly. This bill and pill are not in the best interest of or the best way to care for women and their children. Outside of the risks when using this form of abortion and women not being fully informed and supported, I want to appeal your desire for life. Life is difficult for everyone, but it's worth living. Life is the ultimate gift, and we should not be taking that away from anyone. We should be encouraging everyone to live out their life to the fullest. Living life brings unfathomable joys, especially from the hardest of times. By making it easier for a woman to end the life of their child, you will not only be preventing the child's opportunity to experience their own life, but assisting women choosing the easy way out that will inhibit their own life, as well as adding unfathomable sorrows that death brings. NIH's 2020 study found that nearly two-thirds of pregnancies where the child tests positive for Down syndrome were aborted. My son Asher, who has Down syndrome, is eight years old today, and life looks different for us.
Ms. Wagner, you're at time.
At two already?
Yes. Yes, ma'am.
Oh, I'm sorry. Can I just finish one sentence?
Yes, ma'am. Sentences. Yep.
This bill will make the easy way out easier to choose. Life isn't easy, and it's not supposed to be. Choose life to its fullest for everyone. Oppose or amend this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Wagner. Next in the queue, we have Ritul Rabari calling from Anchorage. Please put yourself on the record. You have 2 minutes for public testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Fields, Chair Hall, and the members of the committee. My name is Ritul Rabari. I'm a manager for the patient care services with Albertsons Companies. We operate about 21 community pharmacies across Alaska under the CARS and the Safeway banner. I'm here today to support of the House Bill 195. In many Alaskan communities, the local pharmacy is one of the most accessible healthcare touchpoints. Patients often come to us first, sometimes because they cannot get the same week appointment or the same day appointments, and sometimes they're simply the closest healthcare professional available. House Bill 195 allows a pharmacist to provide the care for the preventative services, minor acute conditions, and test-to-treat scenarios within the standard of care framework. This is not about the replacing physicians. It is about ensuring the patient receives the timely care when appropriate and referred when condition exceeds our scope of practice. Pharmacists are trained to assess the symptoms, identify the red flags, initiate appropriate therapy when clinically indicated, and refer the patients when necessary. That triage function is already happening every day in our pharmacies. I have practiced in Alaska community since last two and a half years as a pharmacist and manage about our 21 stores across Alaska. And I can tell you that there are many instances where patients needed either strep test or the flu test, and that could have prevented it for the emergency care visits for many of our patients across Alaska. States like Idaho, Colorado, Montana, and Iowa has adopted the similar pharmacist full practice authority model under the community standard of care. Their experience shows that no evidence of patient safety concerns for Alaska, where access challenges are real, and this is a practical and measured step forward. I respectfully urge your support for the House Bill 195. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next in the queue, we have Pat Martin calling from Anchorage with Alaska Right to Life. Please put yourself on the record and begin your 2 minutes of testimony. Pat Martin, are you available?
right. Yes, thank you, Chair Hall. Okay. My name is Patrick Martin. I'm with Alaska Right to Life. And I'd like to start off by saying that to all the wonderful Alaskans that have called and emailed their opposition to HB 195, I want to say thank you for standing for life. Thanks to you, hundreds of petitions have been submitted from Ketchikan to Tuvok to Unalaska opposing these dangerous and deadly bills. Unfortunately, some of the bill sponsors and supporters want you to believe that federal and state law somehow prohibits pharmacists from dispensing abortion pills, so you shouldn't be worried about it. But this is not the case. Current mifepristone is not listed on any relevant controlled substances list, and its REMS only limits prescriptions to 10 weeks gestation. There are no other restrictions. But if the supporters of this bill are willing to lie to you about what it means to be human, if they're willing to lie to you about what about the clump of cells that isn't human, that isn't alive, it isn't a person, and it isn't a boy or a girl, or that he or she doesn't have any rights until she draws her first breath, well, they'll lie to you about the purpose of this bill and their opposition to even a single restriction on abortion. Ladies and gentlemen, regardless of any amendments to date and any that are forthcoming, the only acceptable outcome for HB 195 and SB 147 is for these bills to be defeated in committee or to be withdrawn by their bill sponsors. Alaska Right to Life stands firmly opposed to these bills.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Next in the queue, we have Teresa Syrum. I apologize if I'm mispronouncing your last name, calling from Anchorage. Ma'am, please put your name on the record and begin your testimony. You have 2 minutes.
My name is Therese Siren, and I would like to testify against this bill in regard to Ashley Faber's comment that a dozen other states already allow direct patient care by pharmacists. That is actually a very strong mark against it. Why have, until recently, all 50 states prohibited pharmacists prescribing and selling any kind of, medicine? Because that is because the ultimate standard of care is that only a doctor who has taken the Hippocratic Oath is allowed to prescribe. A doctor or someone under very close, immediate supervision. And this bill would allow a pharmacist, completely unsupervised, to actually prescribe anything. There are no limits. The only reason, in fact, that anyone would propose such a preposterous a bill against the entire foundation of practice of medicine, according to the Hippocratic Oath, is that because they do want to introduce abortion itself. So this is throwing women under the bus again, as Patrick pointed out. If you're willing to kill babies, what's the more harm to women? So what? And it particularly throws Native women under the bus who are out in these remote areas.
Thank you, Ms. Syrum.
Is that my time?
Yes, ma'am, that is. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next in the queue, we have Rebecca Myers. Ms. Myers, please put yourself on the record and begin your 2 minutes of testimony.
Well, greetings from Fairbanks. I am Rebecca Myers. I'm speaking in opposition and on my own behalf. In the public testimonies of Senate Bill 147, most of the support of this bill came from pharmacists. This is not surprising. But I ask myself, what's the difference between pharmacists and physicians? And the American Medical Association answers that well. One of the most obvious things that distinguishes physicians from pharmacists is the length, focus, and depth of their training. Pharmacists get 4 years of postgraduate education. That's about 1,700 hours of clinical training, but they don't have residency requirements. Physicians, on contrast, they get 4 years of the postgraduate education. They get 12,000 to 16,000 hours of clinical training, and that is in their 3 to 7 years of residencies. In addition, physician education includes performing differential diagnosis, treating patients for a broad range of illness and disease, caring for patients during each phase of life cycle. But the pharmacists, they do not have that training. They don't even conduct physical examinations. So a pharmacist receiving 2 to 4 hour trainings here and there cannot possibly make up the difference in that. You know, it's common sense that points us to the conflict of interest that resides in the individual who is both able to prescribe and fill a script. Our healthcare system is currently overwhelmed. I have experienced this firsthand. I recognize that this is the case. But calling on one discipline to carry out the burden and responsibility that belongs to the expertise and scope of care of another discipline, that is foolish. So I'm asking you to practice wisdom and righteousness. I am asking you to oppose HB 195 because it will fracture the interdisciplinary approach to healthcare, and it will open up Pandora's box of mixing disciplines. A pharmacist
is not a
physician.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Myers. You are at time. Next in the queue, we have Sarah Spencer. Ms. Spencer, will you please put yourself on the record and begin your 2 minutes of testimony?
Hi. Are you able to hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Dr. Sarah Spencer. I'm an addiction medicine specialist working in tribal health in Nanilchik, and I support HB 195. I've been a physician treating patients with substance use disorders in rural Alaska for 17 years. And in Alaska, we are lagging far behind the rest of the U.S. in addressing the overdose crisis. In particular, overdose death rates for Alaska Native people are 4 times the national average. We know that the number one most effective way to reduce death from opioid use disorder is medication for the treatment of addiction, or MAT, which increases people's chances, reduces people's chances of dying by over 60%. Very few medications in modern medicine are that effective at saving lives from a deadly disease. But unfortunately, many people live in areas in Alaska that don't have any local medical clinics that offer medication for addiction treatment. In 2023, the federal government changed the law to allow pharmacists to prescribe and manage medication for the treatment of opioid use disorder. And prior to that, numerous states have authorized CPAs for MAT, and also the VA has had great success with allowing their pharmacists to manage this medication for addiction treatment, with excellent quality outcome measures exceeding national averages. This could be a game changer for addiction treatment in Alaska. My patients sometimes travel over 200 miles round trip to my office to get their monthly medication shot to treat their opioid addiction. And we as addiction specialists could greatly expand our service area if we were allowed to create CPAs with pharmacists to administer these monthly medication injections at pharmacies statewide. And this has already been happening for years in Montana through the Albertsons grocery chain. There are already standards of practice in place for CPAs to support addiction treatment in numerous states across the country, and the published data has shown that CPAs safely and effectively increase access to medication for addiction treatment. So I respectfully urge the committee to pass HB 195.
Thank you, Dr. Spencer. With that, next we have Jeff Maupin. Mr. Maupin, will you please put yourself on the record and begin your 2 minutes of testimony?
Hi. My name is Jeff Maupin, Congressman Barrow. Today I'm reading from a fact sheet from the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and quote, in the most comprehensive U.S. study to date of abortion pill safety, the Ethics and Public Policy Center, EPPC, analyzed insurance claims data from 865,727 mifepristone abortions, 2017 to 2023. The study identified a serious adverse event rate of 10.93%, but notably excluded a majority of the emergency room visits to avoid overstating risk. And so their conclusion, I'm turning the page, is that the EPP study presents a careful and conservative assessment of abortion pill safety, excluding a vast number of irrelevant or minor events. Even with these exclusions, it finds a 22 times higher rate of serious complications than reported by the FDA and drug manufacturers. So I'm opposing House Bill 195, and thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Maupin. Next in the queue, we have Joseph Albeats calling from Anchorage. Mr. Albeats, will you please put yourself on the record and begin your 2 minutes of testimony?
Thank you. My name is Joseph Albeats. I'm in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm a pediatric critical care physician in Anchorage, and I'm calling in support of House Bill 195. As an IC physician, I have the privilege to work with a multidisciplinary team whose members have to work at the top of their scope to provide care to the sickest children in the state. This care would not be possible without a constant partnership of our pharmacists, working with our physicians, nurses, and the rest of the medical team. Some of our most effective and reliable system-based interventions we need in ICU parallel the responsibilities under collaborative practice agreements that House Bill 195 proposes. Empowering our pharmacists to consult and drive medication management and monitoring in partnership with our physicians routinely improves safety, timeliness, consistency, and reduction of costs in our ICU. I would expect an expanded outpatient scope of prescriptive authority outlined in HB 195 to have similar impacts. Furthermore, prior to relocating to Alaska, I practiced for 15 years as a university-based IC physician in Colorado, where pharmacists have full practice authority similar to what is being considered. We had a very positive experience with that. Colorado practices being able to make it easier for people to receive timely, safe, cost-effective care for their treatment of well-defined minor ailments by improving the access to clinicians in rural locations. Their pharmacists also serve to relieve the patient load from physician offices, urgent cares, and emergency departments, which are frequently busy, more remote, and oftentimes more expensive to use. Expanded practice authority for pharmacists did not replace physicians. It allowed both professions to operate at the top of our scopes, and the patients have benefited. I'm excited to see Alaska continue to innovate its healthcare system to meet the unique and unmet needs of its people, and I feel House Bill 195 is a solid step in that direction. I'd like to thank the committee for its time and consideration and encourage you to pass HB 195. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Albeats. Next in the queue, we have Hunter Taylor from Juneau. Please put yourself on the record and begin your 2 minutes of testimony.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. Thank you for your time today. For the record, my name is Hunter Taylor, and I am currently a fourth-year Doctor of Pharmacy student at the Idaho State University, University of Alaska Anchorage College of Pharmacy. I was born and raised in Alaska and plan on practicing in the state after I graduate this May. While doing my 3 years of didactic coursework for this doctorate program, I lived in Idaho and was able to experience firsthand how important independent prescribing by pharmacists is. I worked for Albertson's Pharmacy in Pocatello, Idaho as a student pharmacist, and I helped to assess many women who came in the store looking for help with the UTI. Albertson's has a protocol for UTI assessment and treatment where the patient fills out a brief questionnaire, including questions such as, have you experienced a UTI before? What symptoms are you experiencing, and questions relevant in ruling out pyelonephritis or complicated UTI. As long as the patient qualified as an uncomplicated UTI and their vitals were normal, which we were able to take and assess in the vaccine room, we were able to proceed. We would then discuss their allergy history and write a prescription if indicated. The company had 3 or 4 different antibiotics to choose from to treat the UTI, and the choice is based on the patient's allergy history, what they have used before, if they've had a previous UTI, and if it worked. Otherwise, it was up to the pharmacist's discretion on which antibiotic to choose. Then we would counsel the patient on the medication, answer any questions that they had, and we were able to dispense medication right there for them. And then 3 or 4 days later, we did follow up with the patient. We called them, asked if the UTI resolved, if they needed any additional care, and any feedback from the patient. Due to this experience at Albertson's and the fact that I will be practicing as a licensed pharmacist in Alaska in a few months, I strongly support House Bill 195 and respectfully urge the committee to pass the bill in order to improve access to safe and timely pharmacy care for Alaskans. Thank you.
Thank you. Next in the queue, we have Soren White calling from Sitka from White's Pharmacy. Will you please put yourself on the record and begin your 2 minutes of testimony?
Good afternoon, committee. My name is Soren White. I am a second-generation community pharmacist living and working in Sitka, Alaska. Obviously, Alaska. I stand in strong support of House Bill 195. This bill is really all about expanding health care in a safe and efficient manner. We live in one of the lowest population states, which, you know, is part of the beauty, but that comes with some drawbacks. Obviously, one of those is access to health care. Here in Sitka, we only have one hospital. It's Search the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium. There's no private practice doctors except for some dentists, a couple dentists and an eye doctor. And some veterinarians as well. But often search physicians are really busy. They have very packed schedules. It's very hard to see patients in a reasonable time frame, resulting in people needing to go to urgent or emergency care for things as simple as something like a strep throat, which we could test for. The pharmacy, obviously, we are always open, such as today on Elizabeth Bradovich Day or President's Day. Our pharmacy was open while the general practitioners here in Sitka was not. We're hands down the easiest and most accessible healthcare professional in the nation. Additionally, obviously, anyone who is finishing pharmacy school anymore has a PharmD, which is a doctorate degree. We have more school than other prescribing authorities, such as physician's assistants, who are able to freely prescribe within their respective bounds. Not saying that PAs shouldn't be doing that. They do an amazing job and grant access to people where doctors and MDs are unavailable. It's just a comparison. Obviously, we are all working together in this healthcare program, and adding additional pharmacists who have doctorates in pharmaceuticals would just increase the accessibility for patients. And during my school, in pharmacy school, I went to Oregon State University. Throughout the 4 years of postgraduate work, we were required to work with patient actors, which included physical testing, diagnosing, prescribing medications with a patient right there.
Mr. White,
so what I'm trying to say is pharmacists... Sorry. Can I just finish up quick?
Yes, please.
Okay, sorry. So, yeah, I was just trying to say, I'm here in strong support of House Bill 195, and thank you all for your time, happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Next in the queue, we have Pamela Samash. I apologize if I'm butchering your last name. I'm calling from Fairbanks. Will you please put yourself on the record and begin your 2 minutes of testimony?
Hi, thank you. And no, it's okay. My last name, there's only five of us in America. So you would probably, I don't even know how to say it right, so it's okay. I'm calling from the Nano, Alaska, I would like you to oppose HB 195. I don't support it, first of all, because I personally have transported a young woman who was hemorrhaging because of the mifepristone, I probably said that wrong, cocktail. And this bill does not stop pharmaceutical people from distributing the abortion drug. I got her in the hospital in like 10 minutes, but I live in a rural area. And had that happened to her in my town of Nanama, she would have died. She would have bled to death and died in my car. So I know for a fact that that stuff is dangerous. And when I got her to the hospital, I asked the ER doctor, why is this happening to her? And he said, with the abortion drugs, they always get women hemorrhaging with them. And it's like normal. And it's nothing like a miscarriage. And I did send an email about that. So because this does not stop pharmaceutical or pharmacies from distributing abortion drugs, I absolutely don't support it. And the other reason I don't support it is, I mean, when I go to the pharmacy to pick up, like, my husband's prescription for, you know, his recent knee replacement, like, I'm not going to sit there and talk to them about our medical history to get a drug or something. That's just nuts. Like, there's a whole line of people behind us. And I just think that is a private thing with the doctor and their patient. So I just think the whole thing is totally inappropriate. I mean, you're Fred Meyers, and you're going to talk to them about what your woman's issue or something, I mean, or your knee or your bladder. I mean, what? That doesn't even make sense. So I would just ask that you would just get rid of this bill and keep it the way it already is. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Next in the queue, we have Carrie Urena. Again, apologize if I'm butchering the last name. Please put yourself on the record and begin your 2 minutes of testimony.
Hello, my name is Carrie Urena. I'm a pharmacist currently working in an opioid treatment program here in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm calling today to express my strong support for the House Bill 195. Although I now practice in Anchorage, I've previously worked in rural communities in Southeast Alaska and have family members who continue to live in these areas. Through both my professional and personal experiences, I have seen firsthand the tremendous need for healthcare services in our state, especially in our rural communities, and the significant gaps that still exist. These challenges become even more pronounced when we look at access to specialized care, including treatment for opioid use disorder. Methadone treatment in particular can only be dispensed through certified opioid treatment programs. While these programs are highly regulated to ensure patient safety, recent federal regulatory updates were specifically designed to improve and expand access to medications for opioid use disorder, which is an urgent national priority. Part of these updates broaden the definition of practitioner to include pharmacists as potential providers of care. However, this opportunity depends on the individual states granting pharmacists the authority to prescribe and dispense these controlled medications. Currently, Alaska does not allow this, which limits our ability as pharmacists to help address access barriers and expand these life-saving treatment services. Given Alaska's unique geography and the healthcare access challenges that this creates, I believe it's critically important that we use every available resource and professional expertise to serve our communities. Pharmacists are not seeking to replace any other healthcare professionals. Rather, what we're asking for is the ability to work collaboratively, hand in hand with physicians, nurses, and behavioral health providers to expand access, strengthen existing services, and ensure that more Alaskans can receive the care that they need. I truly believe that through collaboration and by using each professional's strengths to fill in the gaps and cares that we have here, that we can overcome the unique challenges that our state faces. For these reasons, I respectfully urge you to support the passage of House Bill 195. Thank you for the time and the opportunity to share my perspective and my deep commitment to strengthening health care for all of our Alaskan people.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Margaret Adsett calling from Palmer. Ms. Adsett, will you please put yourself on the record and begin your 2 minutes of testimony?
Hi. For the record, my name is Margaret Adsett. I'm from Palmer, Alaska. Can you hear me? Because you guys were cutting in and out over the past two testimonies.
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, great. Again, my name is Margaret. I'm a mom of two young kids, and we're living in the Palmer area. I want to talk about sort of what it's like to go through pharmacy-based care. Recently, we spent 2 months in France. In past years, we've also been in Costa Rica and Japan, all which have pharmacy-based care models. Over the past 3 years, we've had many instances where my kids got sick and used pharmacy-based care, in which we received care both for needing an inhaler, ear infections, UTIs, all treated by pharmacies, and all in a very sort of supportive atmosphere wherein the pharmacist was able to diagnose and provide care and or recommend if we needed to go on to further medical care. It, in by contrast to the U.S.-based system or in Alaska, spending hours in urgent care, not being able to get into appointments for days on end with pediatricians and the like for sort of minor illnesses meant a world of difference in terms of immediacy of care and just not overtaxing an already taxed system. And I can see this as a benefit to other parents across the state of Alaska just for a treatment. So I'm super in support of HB 195 just to, again, get access, earlier access for kids and treating them for minor illnesses that clog our emergency rooms and urgent cares. Thank you so much and have a lovely day. I'm going to go take care of two of the kids now.
Thank you, Ms. Adsett. Best of luck. Next in the queue, we have Eric Holland calling from Anchorage. Mr. Holland, will you please put yourself on the record and begin your 2 minutes of testimony?
Hi, good afternoon all. My name is Eric Holland and I'm calling from Anchorage. I'm a student pharmacist in the UAA Idaho State University Doctor of Pharmacy program. I'm calling to voice our Alaska student body's strong support for House Bill 195. I began working in a community pharmacy as a UA undergrad, and I cannot even begin to tell you how many times a day our pharmacy was approached by a member of the public asking for help with routine, easy-to-treat conditions. Historically, we've only ever been able to offer them advice, recommendations for over-the-counter meds or non-pharmacological options before ultimately having to refer them to an urgent care or the emergency department for any prescription treatments, putting additional burdens on an already overstressed healthcare system. As my schoolmate Hunter spoke so eloquently about earlier, our Idaho-based doctor of pharmacy program teaches us the techniques required to assess, diagnose, and treat a wide array of ailments to prepare us for working in clinical settings in Idaho, where pharmacists enjoy full prescriptive authority in alignment with their education, training, and expertise. The vast majority of our Alaska students are lifelong Alaskans that want to practice in their home communities. I respectfully urge the committee to pass House Bill 195 to improve access to safe, timely pharmacy care for Alaskans and to retain the student body we have here in a state where we can practice for full authority. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Next in the queue, we have Dr. Dan Hartman calling from Anchorage. Dr. Hartman, will you please put yourself on the record and begin your 2 minutes of testimony?
Good afternoon, co-chairs Hall and Fields and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, my name is Dan Hartman. I'm a physician with 24 years of experience treating customer owners across Alaska, and I'm here today to express support for HB 195 on behalf of South Central Foundation. These bills allow pharmacists to practice to the scope and level of their training. These professionals have earned doctoral degrees, have been trained in clinical settings, and have practiced for years in clinical environments. Pharmacists work shoulder to shoulder with physicians and advanced practice providers within SCF's system of care. Pharmacists have the skills needed to appropriately use the authorities they would be given under the policy calls in this bill. South Central Foundation employs over 1,000 licensed healthcare professionals, including dozens of pharmacists across many locations in both urban and rural areas. Pharmacists make up a critical component of South Central Foundation's integrated care team model, which has been designed with an eye towards optimizing accessibility and making efficient use of financial resources while prioritizing better health outcomes. HB 195 will help achieve all three of those goals. This legislation will increase access to certain types of care that would now be performed by pharmacists, including patient care services, as defined in Section 8 on page 6 of Work Draft Version N, that include the prescribing or administering of a drug. Additionally, at a time of workforce shortages, this legislation will help to expand the healthcare workforce that can take on certain care responsibilities. The recognition of the scope of pharmacist training, as well as placing appropriate guardrails on the prescribing of opioids, are both appreciated. Please continue to support HB 195. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Hartman. Next in the queue, we have Joshua Max calling from Anchorage. Mr. Max, please put yourself on the record and begin your 2 minutes of testimony.
Hello, my name is Joshua Max, and I'm the district pharmacy manager with Albertson's Company. From November 2020 to January 2026, I was the pharmacy manager at the Safeway in Homer, where the nearest urgent care is over 70 miles away in Sylvan. I frequently had to refer patients to the emergency room for conditions that could be safely and effectively managed in a community pharmacy setting. The most common example of this is influenza, an illness that does not require an ER visit, yet in many rural Alaska communities, the ER becomes the only timely option when primary care appointments are booked days or even weeks out. I also routinely see travelers who have full medical histories available through their patient portals, but have forgotten essential medicines at home and cannot reach their primary provider. In these situations, despite clear medical need and evidence of diagnoses, I am unable to provide even a short emergency supply of critical medications such as antiarrhythmics or anticoagulants, leaving the ER as their only resource. These two things are precisely the gaps in access that House Bill 195 is designed to address. I respectfully urge your support for House Bill 195. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Max. Next in the queue, we have Elise Martin calling from Wasilla. Ms. Martin, please put yourself on the record to begin your 2 minutes of testimony.
Hi, my name is Elise Martin. I'm calling from Wasilla. I'd like to strongly...
Ms. Martin, you're cutting out. Can you hear us? Ms. Martin? Okay, Ms. Martin, we will come back to you in the queue. Next, we are going to hear from Margaret Miller, also calling from the Mattoo Valley. Ms. Miller, will you please put yourself on the record and begin your 2 minutes of testimony?
Hi, my name is Margaret Miller. I'm calling on behalf of myself in opposition to House Bill 195. If passed, this bill would expand access to mifepristone to virtually every city, town, and rural area of Alaska. 1 in 10 mifepristone tablets causes serious life-threatening complications for women, serious or life-threatening. The risk to women in rural and remote Alaska is great because a lot of these people don't have access to emergency rooms and hospitals that they would need. In these life-threatening situations, the most frequently reported adverse effects of this drug are hemorrhaging, infection, missed ectopic pregnancies, and death. Also, of course, every mifepristone tablet that a pregnant woman takes kills a child. The FDA website has reported deaths from this drug. It would be a tragedy if this bill was passed for the sake of Alaskan lives. All lives should be equally protected. Life-threatening drugs shouldn't be on the market, period. And this bill would give more access to this life-threatening drug. Doctors are not in agreement about this drug. I personally know more than one practitioner who opposes this drug. I strongly oppose this bill, and I hope all Alaskans will see the importance of opposing the same. I'd also like to echo what one of the first callers said. I believe her name was Jessica, that life is worth living and worth protection. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Miller. With that, we'll try going back up the queue to Elise Martin from Wasilla. Ms. Martin, are you there? Okay, not hearing Ms. Martin. I will keep coming back to you when I can. Next in the queue is Jacob John. Mr. John, will you please put yourself on the record and begin your 2 minutes of testimony?
Hello, my name is Dr. Jacob John. I am a pediatrician, pediatric intensivist, and pediatric nephrologist in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm in support of HB 195. The main thing in our job is that, you know, honestly, all the patients that we get, most of them can be helped out a lot by just access to preventative medicine prior to them getting acutely ill and coming in to see us. Things like smoking cessation, contraception management, treatment of opioid addiction, immunizations, and treatment of flu or strep. All of these things are things that can benefit our overall healthcare system and reduce the burden of on providers that are in the front lines of actually taking care of a lot of other conditions that require a little bit more nuance. So the idea of having someone to help us in being able to manage some of these conditions is incredibly beneficial. That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Dr. John. Next in the queue, we have Gina Demasel. God, I'm butchering these names. I apologize. Please put yourself on the record and begin your 2 minutes of testimony.
Hi, thank you, members of the committee and co-chairs, for the time to speak today. My name is Gina Demaselis. I've been a physician for over 20 years. I've been a pediatric critical care physician for over 12 years, and I've been working here in Alaska for 2 years. I'm a resident and employee here in Anchorage. I'm here to support House Bill 195. My entire career, the multidisciplinary team is crucial. Pharmacists are highly educated individuals, with a growing number of our pharmacists all now having doctorates. I'd like to emphasize that physicians are not only the members in our community who prescribe medications and forgetting our nurse practitioners and physician assistants who also prescribe medications for the public, I think is a disservice to those members of our medical team. I have additionally worked in Colorado, one of the 20 states that allow pharmacists to have this expanded service. And I have many friends who are pharmacists in Colorado. And in my experience, the expanded scope was both safe and improved patient and family experience by giving them increased access to care for minor illnesses and routine care. In addition, these pharmacists found great improved job satisfaction and actually sought states to be employed in to be able to have this job experience. I'd like to take a moment to appeal to your softer side. Here in Alaska, we have a large state with many residents living in rural and remote areas with limited access to care. Please imagine being an asthmatic, needing albuterol, being short of breath, and not being able to get in to see your PCP provider today and needing to potentially go into an emergency room for over 12 hours when if you could just have access to getting your albuterol, you would not fear for your life. I am concerned about human life, and therefore I want to echo my substance abuse colleagues and concern that having additional medical team members able and skilled in helping to treat patients with substance abuse problems is vital. I think that a woman's right to choose for abortion is another issue that does not need to be brought up in this House bill, and that that is something that if residents or committee members are interested in bringing up, that that should be a separate bill to be addressed. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next in the queue, we have Kathleen Wedemeyer calling from Seattle. Ms. Wedemeyer, would you please put yourself on the record and provide your 2 minutes of testimony?
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Kathleen Wedemeyer. I'm with the Citizens Commission on Human Rights, a psychiatric watchdog group. We're asking you to please vote no on or amend HB 195. While not directly authorizing it, HB 195 could create a path for pharmacists to diagnose psychiatric or behavioral health conditions by removing state oversight of collaborative care agreements and by not specifically prohibiting the prescribing of drugs that are primarily used to treat psychiatric and behavioral health conditions. While pharmacist education includes extensive training in pharmacology and patient assessment, they do not have the education and medical treatment for a differential diagnosis, for example, or medical assessment. This ability is necessary for safely diagnosing and treating complex medical or psychiatric conditions and to rule out physical conditions with symptoms that mimic behavioral or mental health disorders. The AMA, every state medical association, and many other professional medical associations, such as the American Academy of Family Physicians and the American Academy of Pediatrics, oppose extending pharmacist prescribing authority. Please vote no or amend HB 195. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next in the queue, and I'll just make a quick note, the previous testifier, Elise Martin, she dropped off, so unfortunately, if she comes back on, then I'll certainly go back to her. Next in the queue, we have Tom Wadsworth calling from Wasilla. Mr. Wadsworth, please put yourself on the record and provide 2 minutes worth of testimony.
Hi, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tom Wadsworth. I've practiced pharmacy in Alaska and Idaho for over 23 years and have spent 19 years as a pharmacy educator. I am board certified in pharmacotherapy and completed postgraduate residency training in internal medicine. For the purpose of this testimony, I speak as the dean of the Ella Skaggs College of Pharmacy, which delivers the UAA ISU Doctor of Pharmacy program, in which you've heard from a few of our students here in Anchorage. And I'm proud to say we're celebrating 10 years of training Alaskans in Alaska for Alaska. And on behalf of the college, we are unequivocally in support of House Bill 195. I'd like to focus on pharmacist education and training. A doctor of pharmacy graduate completes 2 to 3 years of undergraduate biomedical preparation, followed by 4 years of a doctoral professional program. During those 4 years, they complete well over 2,000 of didactic education in physiology, pathophysiology, pharmacology, medicinal chemistry, pharmacokinetics, therapeutics, and clinical decision making. They then complete over 1,700 hours of supervised direct patient care across many healthcare settings and disciplines. Many pursue residency training, which adds thousands of additional structured clinical hours. Nationally, there are more than 60 board certification specialties in pharmacy and thousands of accredited residency programs in the country. Tens of thousands of pharmacists hold advanced certification and residency training, many of them here in Alaska. This is doctoral level healthcare education focused specifically on medication therapy and therapeutic decision making. With this training, pharmacists bring specialized expertise to the healthcare team. They're focused on selecting the right medication at the right dose for the right patient at the right time and ensuring that it is used safely and effectively. This bill does not grant open-ended authority. It aligns statute with the rigorous education pharmacists already receive and the responsibilities they are already trained and qualified to perform. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wadsworth. Next in the queue, we have Alan Hippler calling from Anchorage. Mr. Hippler, please put yourself on the record, and you have 2 minutes for your testimony.
Thank you. This is Alan Hippler from Anchorage, Alaska. I'm calling in opposition to this bill. First of all, I would oppose any extension of the availability of abortifacients. Second of all, while it is arguable that both pharmacists and chiropractors, for example, should have more prescription authority, that would be better suited in a separate bill. And in fact, I would support that if chiropractors and pharmacists would have some limited prescription writing ability for antibiotics, for example, very supportive. But this I have to strongly oppose. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony. Next in the queue is Felicity Young from Wasilla. Ms. Young, please put yourself on the record and begin your 2 minutes of testimony.
Thank you. My name is Felicity Young, and I'm calling from Wasilla. I've personally taken mifepristone twice after missed miscarriages, and both times I ended up with a retained placenta. The second time, I was fortunate to be in a hospital for monitoring while on the drug. I hemorrhaged and had to have emergency surgery and a blood transfusion. And this is a very common story in a miscarriage group I'm in. So I'm shocked to hear that this drug is being considered for disbursement without direct medical oversight. Not only is mifepristone prescribed to abort babies, but it's a danger to women, especially in remote areas. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Young. With that, that is all the folks who have called in online for public testimony. Is there anybody else in the audience for public testimony? Not seeing any. I will now close public testimony. Public testimony is now closed. As a reminder to those who are interested in still providing comments, you can do so by emailing the committee. That email address is house.labor.and.commerce@akleg.gov. I'd like to offer or have a moment here for Dr. Brandy Sinda-Martin from the Pharmacy Association to make a brief comment before we take the next steps as a committee. Dr. Sinda-Martin, are you there?
Hello, this is Dr. Brandy Sinda-Martin. Thank you so much, Chair Hall, Co-Chair Hall. I just wanted to come off mute and actually just say that this bill should really not be used as a proxy for debates on abortion. This bill is neutral on reproductive health policy and does not alter Alaska's abortion laws. We currently have a statute that says that abortion has to be done in a hospital or other approved setting, of which pharmacies are not those approved settings, but nothing in this bill changes that, actually. And then following the Supreme Court Dobbs decision, which put abortion policy back onto the states, the Attorney General clarified through a letter that said that state-licensed pharmacies are not approved facilities to dispense mifepristone. The Anchorage Daily News has actually reported on this fact, the fact that community pharmacies in Alaska currently are not dispensing these medications quite a few times, actually. So due to these factors, we believe that this legislation is actually completely neutral on the issue of abortion, and I would be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Sinda-Martin. With that, are there any final member questions on HB 195 for Dr. Sinda-Martin or for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, Mr. Co-Chair, can I get a motion on HB 195?
Yes. I move to report House Bill 195, version LS0909/N, as amended with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Okay. Seeing no objections, HB 195, version LS0909/N as amended is reported out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes. We're going to take a brief at ease to sign the committee paperwork, and we will also start transitioning to our presentation. At ease. The next item on the agenda is a presentation on non-resident workers in Alaska. The first speaker will be Dan Robinson from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Mr. Robinson, please come forward, introduce yourself for the record, and begin your presentation. We also have the second presenter on this topic will be Dr. Brett Watson with ICER, and he's available virtually.
Thank you. My name is Dan Robinson. I'm the research chief at the Alaska Department of Labor and for Workforce Development. I had a presentation. Is it not loaded up? And it's short. So if it's gonna, okay. And while that's getting loaded, I'll just mention this is from an article we did in the February issue of Alaska Economic Trends. And that pulls from a report we do every year detailing non-resident workers in Alaska.
At ease. All right, we are back on record again here with Dan Robinson from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. We have the PowerPoint up and available. Mr. Robinson, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Chair Hall. I'll have three slides that are right out of the article and then a couple of others that kind of summarize this data broadly on non-resident workers in Alaska. And then I'd be glad to answer any questions you have. This first slide shows the long-term percentage of non-resident workers and resident workers as well. The focus from the article was mostly on the recent history and the increasing percentage of people who work in Alaska who are non-residents. As you see in 2024, it's 22.9%. That about 95,000 of the people who worked in Alaska in 2024 were non-residents out of 420,000 total. A couple of key points there, just that you get counted if you work at all. So non-residents tend to work for fewer months of the year. And we can talk more about that to the extent you're interested and curious. This next chart, right from the article, shows wages. Keep in mind that 22.9% 6.9% workers. Total wages, the percentage of wages that go to non-resident Alaskans, 17.3%. Comfortably the highest it's ever been since we've been doing this work. You can see a steady increase. And the, well, I'll come to the hypothesis that we talk a little bit about in the article in a minute. $3.8 billion out of roughly $22 billion that's paid in wage and salaries to Alaska workers. Small note, this excludes federal government and military. But if you get a paycheck in Alaska and you're, with the exception of federal government, you're in this data set. So this just looks at some select industries. The ones not included would be kind of miscellaneous other. These are the ones that policymakers will probably be most interested in, and it does capture not all, but the bulk of the numbers. So the blue line is the worker count. The red line is the wage aggregation total. And you can see that by far the industry with the highest percentage of non-residents is seafood processing, down to a low of state and local government. The state and local government, one small note there, the criteria for residency is a PFD, permanent fund dividend. And as you know, you have to be here for a full calendar year. So some of these non-residents are likely new residents that just haven't yet, and some of them may never qualify for a dividend because they won't spend enough time in Alaska to qualify.
Thank you, Mr. Robinson. Representative Sadler has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just through the chair, Mr. Robinson, just real quick. So the takeaway from this graph is that non-resident workers earn less than their proportional share. Every category we have here.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, yes. With kind of an important caveat that if you compared their quarterly earnings, it's not that they take lower wage jobs, but they spend less time working in Alaska. So non-resident workers, three-quarters of them only work one-quarter of a year. And this is a sum of their wages over the course of the year.
And again, a follow-up?
Follow-up.
So again, just in seafood processing, there's just 81.5% of seafood processing workers are non-resident, and 69% of the wages paid in the seafood processing industry are paid to non-resident. Am I reading it right?
That's correct.
Good. Thanks.
Yes. Yes, and one thing we pointed out in the article is that it's not unusual for the percent of workers in different industries to rise and fall, especially with our large projects, TAPS being the most obvious one, but Planet Willow and Pikka and Alpine before that. When big things happen in Alaska, when mines open, sometimes we get a surge of non-resident workers, and then it goes back. This current 3 or 4 years, a little more than that actually, is different. With the exception of seafood processing, which is seeing declining numbers overall, what we're seeing is in every industry an increased number and percentage of non-resident workers, which is new for Alaska.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair. Thanks for this, Mr. Robinson. I'm also curious about do we have any way that we're capturing former Alaska residents who maybe move outside of the state and then still commute for work in these industries?
Representative Carrick, through the chair, yes. Once you're in, once you've applied for a dividend, we kind of know who you are. We haven't done a lot of that kind of work, a little bit of who comes and goes. We do it a little bit more with young people. When they go to college, do they come back, and to what extent? We could do it. We have the capacity. So you understand the dividend file. You understand that we have, once we know you are or were a resident, we can check on that. So yes, we have the capacity, and we've done a little bit.
Representative Sadler.
I mean, thank you, Madam Chair. And the far right, state and local government, that kind of intrigues me. I could understand. Did you break that ever down? Did you ever break that down between state and local government? Because I'm just curious, having out-of-state workers, you know, 7 or 10% of government workers not being Alaska or local residents. That's just kind of intriguing.
Yeah, Representative Sadler, through the chair, that's part of why I made that point about these being to an extent, new residents. So when you first come to Alaska, and if you can't find people for whatever reason, somebody's new, they're by other criteria a resident, they've moved to Juneau or Anchorage or Fairbanks, but they haven't yet qualified for a dividend. So it's almost certainly the majority of that kind of person. And what we do is we track that in future years to see what portion of of those people become residents eventually, and a lot of them do. This next slide, so this shows the percentage of the industry workers and wages that go to these people, and this just quantifies by worker and wages the non-resident. So you see, for example, visitor-related, which is a surrogate for tourism. Tourism is hard to capture in the data sets, but there are 24,000 workers, and those workers made in 2024 $552 million. And part of what you see here is the fact that there are two different types of non-resident workers in Alaska. One are workers who come for seasonal work. So seafood processing and tourism are the biggest categories there. The jobs just don't exist year-round, and the quantities of them are huge. Skagway, for example. Skagway's local population has nowhere near the workforce to fill those jobs. Bristol Bay with seafood processing, big, big numbers. So we just don't have the Alaska residents in number to fill those jobs. That's one type. The other type are remote workers, quite often high wage. So the tourism and seafood processing, fairly low wage. Oil and gas, mining, remote work sites, 2 week on, 2 week off, or some variation of that schedule. And people who are going to commute a long ways, whether it's to Palmer or to Fairbanks or somewhere else, it's a unique type of work where they can choose where to live. Because of that whole work site, remote work site, and the work arrangement. And so you see oil and gas, for example, a fairly small number of workers, 4,200 who are non-residents, but a very high wage aggregation for those workers. And metal mining would be a little bit similar. And at the opposite, in seafood processing, a whole lot of workers and relatively, it's still a lot of wages, $365 million. And this, I alluded to this a little bit earlier, the short, not terribly complicated explanation for some of the reason we have more non-residents across most industries is we talked about this when I came a couple of weeks ago, there are fewer Alaskans of working age, so that's 18 to 64. Over roughly the last decade, we've lost about 7% of that group. So it's not that they're, not that anything's big has changed in terms of training or willingness to work or any of those things. There are just fewer of them. And if there are fewer of something, you got to, employers have to do something. And they dabbled a little bit in seniors and youth workers in small numbers. But the most obvious source of additional workers in Alaska has always been non-residents in big numbers. And so the fact that people want to are happy to come here to work, but for reasons that are complicated and nobody can know with precision, they don't want to live here as much as they used to. Working age Alaskans. That's kind of what's behind the increase in non-resident workers and wages in our economy. And I think that's my last slide. It is.
Thank you, Mr. Robinson. We have a question from Co-Chair Fields.
Through the chair, yeah, and I know y'all haven't collected this data, but what I've heard from working age people is they're leaving because class sizes are too large and we don't have adequately funded public services, so they leave. It's interesting when you talk anecdotally, you know, the mines in Southeast Alaska do some of the best jobs of any employers I'm aware of in terms of scholarships, encouraging people to live here, and still half their workers don't live here. So I guess my question would be, what data can you collect going forward so that we can tell when, you know, we underfund schools, it drives working age people out, then employers have to rely on non-residents? Seems like that's what's happening, but obviously we haven't collected that kind of data before to really know the extent to which that is a driver. Thanks.
Well, and Co-Chair Fields, the reasons people move, that it's to a degree, it's qualitative. There are data collected from the Census Bureau and U-Haul, and they're, and we've probably talked about that before, and we definitely have in our articles. It is interesting. You get three or four people together, and three or four people are pretty sure they know the reason. What we quite often say is it's unlikely there is a specific reason. Housing, childcare, that's not unique to Alaska. What is unique to Alaska in the last decade is this unusual budget volatility. So I suspect the mix of things that people care about when they're deciding whether to live somewhere has been affected here. No other state has gone through that, you know, that period that we have. So I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Mr. Robinson. Next in the queue, we have Representative Carrick, followed by Representative Sadler.
Yes, thank you, through the chair. I am also wondering about the component that's workforce development related. So outside of, say, tourism and the visitor industry or the seafood processing industry, the professions that you had listed where we have a lot of non-resident workers are some of the same ones where we have a need for additional workforce training. For example, in healthcare, we don't have a medical school in Alaska. That leads a lot of folks to travel for work. So I don't know if you have a comment or a thought about that factor as well.
Yeah, Representative Carrick, through the chair, we think that is one of the best uses of this report that we do. It shows specifically by occupation the percent of non-resident workers. And when you decide, you mentioned medical school, law school would be another. If Alaska wants, and I'll give you another example that's probably more to the heart of what you can do short term, the shorter term training position. So one of the occupations that caught my eye as I was getting ready to do this was welders. Half of our welders are non-resident workers. Truck drivers, a big percentage of our truck drivers. And some of that is to do with slope work. You know, it's a specific type of work. And again, if those workers can live anywhere, they may want to live somewhere warmer. So there's some what choice of the worker involved there, but we think that's one of the highest best uses of that data. Identified the occupations, high non-residents, look to see if there's a training opportunity, because that's money sitting there waiting to go to residents if we get the things right to, you know, get the companies to care about that enough to recruit and to get the trained workers here and get our state to a place where people want to live here more than they want to live other states, all those things.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Robinson. Next, we have Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Robinson. I appreciate, you know, your data is kind of neutral data. You're not trying to explain why, other than the demographical, about the working age population declining. Certainly this information will inform our policy choices, but I would caution us not to be too reliant on anecdotal explanations. I was back home at Anchorage this weekend, and people told me they're going to move out of Anchorage because the city streets aren't plowed. And that's anecdotal evidence, but we should not let that guide our policy.
Through the chair, yeah, we that was kind of what I was suggesting. There are people who are sure it's oil policy. There, you know, that everybody has a pet theory. To the extent we've shed any light on it, I think what we see is a combination of things, which, and that's not hard to imagine when you think of about the reasons, you know, you would move or you did move. Jobs are obviously a big part of it. Weather. Long list of possibilities.
Yeah. Okay. Co-chair Fields, followed by Representative Coulomb.
Thank you, through the chair. Yeah, I ran the numbers, and if there was a 5% income tax, it would generate $190 million from foreign workers or out-of-state workers, which is kind of stunning that the collective wages are that high among non-resident workers. And maybe this is a question for the future, but, you know, we talk about a lot about different revenue, and my question would always be, well, what is the revenue model that maximizes revenue from people who don't live here? So perhaps the Department of Labor can be of assistance with that in the future.
Well, and Representative Fields, through the co-chair Fields, we will We help revenue a little bit, and I think Brett Watson is going to talk next. They use our data, and this data in particular, percent of wages that go to non-residents. But it's unlikely we will wade into the revenue portion. That's not our lane.
Thank you, Mr. Robinson. Representative Colom.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair, just a couple questions. One is, so I find it's interesting that the federal workers and military are not included. If they were included, how do you think this would affect the percentages of non-resident? It feels like most of those are residents, so wouldn't it change the pie chart?
Through the chair, Representative Colom, I suspect, so military, a couple of interesting things. I think we have a nice record of appealing to former military, so we have the highest percentage of veterans per capita among any state. They are, by nature, at least initially, Coast Guard included, they're new to the state, so they would be very high percentage of non-residents initially.
Right.
Their absence is excused once they become a PFD eligible, so once they're in, they would be able to stay in through deployment and some other things. The federal government, harder to say. We know the federal government workforce is a little, they have higher educational attainment a little bit, and they would be a little stickier by far, for example, than retail trade or some of the lower wage occupations. So I suspect the percent of federal workers who are non-residents would be around what state and local governments are, maybe even a little lower.
Okay.
But that's pretty speculative.
Oh, okay.
Follow up.
And so when you have local, state, I read the original report. When you see state government or local government, at least local, a lot of that is teachers, isn't it?
Representative Colom, through the chair, we, I would have to look. I don't recall. I would bet that you are right. Teachers, it's always a little bit surprising to me how many other occupations there are in local government, but there are a lot of teachers and a little bit like nurses in healthcare, high demand, and lots of anecdotes about coming and going of teachers, Filipino teachers. So that news is out there. I have to look at the data, and it's a little bit trickier to sort data by occupation for government. Government's not as good at reporting as the private sector is.
Okay. Then just one more follow-up. So on page 5 of the original report, it's not in your presentation or anything, there's a list of non-resident workers identified as residents within a year, and the top three were finance and insurance, healthcare, and local government. I found that was really interesting that finance and insurance, they come as a non-resident within a year they're here. Do you have any details on what that is?
Well, Representative Colom, through the chair, those would be people who just to make sure that they're initially identified as non-resident, that percentage of them become residents.
Yes.
So I think it probably says something to the stability of that type of work. Mm-hmm. And at the opposite end, you would see oil and gas. I'm trying to think of some of the other seafood processing, where those people, they come and they're very unlikely to ever become residents. Yeah, so those are at the top end, those are people who are they either do or plan on staying. It's the type of work that you're more likely to you're less floating in the wind. You're more likely to be stable.
Stable. Okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Colom. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the leniency for discussion. Mr. Robinson, just curious, do we pay more attention to non-resident workers in Alaska than other states do? Do other states, you know, trends, magazines, pay this kind of attention? I don't know if we care because it's a bigger leap to move to Alaska or from Alaska, or is it because the Alaska disconnect, or we're all very proud of ourselves and we care a lot about ourselves? Any perspective on that?
Yeah, Representative Sadler, through the chair, it's a fun question. First, other states don't seem to care as much about this as we do, and some of that goes back to our history as a place that was kind of exploited, whether it's the Seattle seafood processors or the Russian fur, whatever. We've always been a rich resource state, And there's been a history of kind of a taking, so that's part of the story. Other states can't do this kind of data because they don't have a permanent fund dividend. A source to identify residents as comprehensively as we do. Other states would be working with DMV data or voter registration data. Neither one would be as full, as comprehensive as the PFD data set. And we do have in our Constitution, and we mention it in our report, the maximum use statute. So I do think Alaskans care a little bit more about it. We have more coming and going than other states. We have the highest migration rates among states. So it's more relevant to our economic health, I think, than any other state. With Hawaii would be a possible exception. Wyoming is kind of interesting. Some of the resource states where they would have some of the same issue. People come in big numbers. They work. They don't ever stay. They never intend to stay. Man camps and that kind of oil and mining. Both West Virginia would have a little bit of that, too.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks. Okay. With that, thank you very much, Mr. Robinson. Sure. We appreciate your time. Next, we are going to hear from Brett Watson from the Institute of Social and Economic Research with the University of Alaska Anchorage. Mr. Watson, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Fields and Hall and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brett Watson, and I'm an associate professor of economics at the University of Alaska Anchorage. And I'm also a researcher with the Institute of Social and Economic Research, or ICER, as we sometimes refer to it. I see that my slides are on your screen. Can you see those clearly?
Yes, we can. Thank you very much.
Fantastic. So I'm going to do a couple of things in this presentation today. If we go to the second slide, I can provide you a brief outline of my remarks. What I'm going to be doing is providing an overview of analysis and results for some work that we recently released related to Alaska fiscal policy. So first, I'll walk you through some context for that work. Then I'll briefly discuss some of the results. But most importantly, we'll be talking today about methodology, particularly as it relates to understanding the relative incidence of sales taxes and income taxes for residents and non-residents. And so this is actually a great follow-up to the previous presentation from Mr. Robinson. If we go to slide 3, I can provide you a little bit more background and a more clear purpose of this presentation. So as many of you know, ICER recently released an update to an analysis that was conducted in 2016, which estimated the economic impacts of fiscal options for the state of Alaska. One particular outcome of interest was the relative burden that these fiscal options would have on residents and non-residents. So what I'll be doing in this presentation today is providing some additional detail on how those estimates were put together. I want to provide an important disclaimer that as in 2016, ICER's preparation of this report was supported with funding from the Office of the Governor of the State of Alaska, but that any work contained here in the companion report, or really any of ICER's work, should be attributable to the researchers and not to ICER, UAA, or the research sponsors. On slide 4 is the key takeaway of this resident versus non-resident incidence question. As I mentioned, my presentation today will focus on two particular fiscal options, namely a set of income tax options and a set of sales tax options. So we're excluding incidence allocation for the permanent fund dividend reduction and property taxes, which were also assessed in that same report. So what I'll be doing is kind of walking through how we arrived at the numbers which appear on this slide. As many of you will recall from the presentation that ICER did in Juneau several weeks ago, we found that a progressive income tax would be associated with an 83% resident incidence, meaning that for every dollar that the state raised from a progressive income tax, Alaska residents would pay 83 cents of that tax, compared to a flat income tax where residents would pay 80 cents. And then we also estimated how residents would pay for a sales tax that excluded more or fewer items. So for a sales tax which had fewer exclusions, or what you might call a broad-based sales tax, we found that residents would pay 76 cents of every dollar. And then for a more narrow sales tax, which would exclude more items, we found that residents would pay 73 cents of every dollar raised.
With that, we're going to turn real quick. Co-chair Fields has a question for you, Dr. Watson.
Yes. What is your definition of PFD reduction, Professor Watson?
Yes, Co-chair Fields, the way that we define a permanent fund dividend reduction is for every dollar of PFD appropriation that was changed, or in our analysis, we calculated a $100 million change, but this would linearly scale to an amount of any arbitrary size. For every dollar or $100 million of PFD change, what percentage of that change would fall on Alaska residents, non-residents of the state of Alaska, and the federal government? So the federal government appears in the yellow bars here, non-residents appear in the green bars, and Alaska residents appear in the gray bars.
Okay, follow.
Follow.
Through the chair, I would just point out, if we spend money through a PFD, or if we spend money through schools, Alaskans are impacted by that, and it's not like we're going to not pay the PFD and then write a check to someone in Nebraska. So I guess that 86% just doesn't make sense to me. But I had another question about what is the definition of a flat income tax? Yeah, in other words, there's an opportunity cost for the PFD, and the opportunity is public services. So it's not like the money just goes away if we don't pay sort of an unrealistic or a fantasy dividend. But I was curious about what is the definition of flat income tax?
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity to clarify this question of opportunity cost. So the way that we modeled each of these fiscal options in our analysis was without any opportunity cost associated with it. So the way that we conceptualized it was to service a hypothetical deficit, meaning that we wouldn't imagine that these funds would be pulled from other sources of state spending, or if PFD allocations were reduced, that those dollars would be reappropriated to any type of state services. That these options were all modeled independently. So you could think about this as money that would be coming into or out of state savings, like the CBR.
Co-Chair Fields, did you have a follow-up?
I was just curious, what is the definition of a flat income tax versus a progressive income tax?
Apologies, yes. So the way that we modeled the progressive income tax option was to copy the progressivity of the federal income tax schedule by assuming a hypothetical surcharge to Alaskans' federal income tax liability. And so, as you may know, the federal income tax system is progressive in nature, meaning that individuals that earn higher incomes pay a marginal tax rate that's a higher level that increases progressively as their incomes rise. So we mirror that progressivity for a state-level income tax by assuming that Alaskans would pay, under this option, a 10% surcharge on their federal income tax. They calculate their federal income tax liability as part of their tax calculations, and their tax bill due to the state of Alaska would be 10% of that federal tax liability, mirroring the federal progressivity. For a flat income tax option, we assume that any Alaskan, regardless of their income, or anyone that earned income in Alaska, regardless of how much income they earned, would pay the same rate, meaning we assumed, I think, a 3% flat rate based on the adjusted gross income of income earned in the state of Alaska.
Okay. Got it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Watson. We have a question from Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think that was my understanding, too, is that the progressive income tax would be a state income tax assessed after the federal progressivity mechanisms were applied. So we'd just be applying that to whatever your, I guess, is AGI. Or whatever, I'm sorry, I don't want to, line 47, whatever, after your federal taxes have been assessed. Very good. Yeah, no question. Just
thank you, Representative Sadler. Mr. Watson, please proceed with your presentation.
So slide 4 presents the general results of our incidence calculation, trying to appropriate that incidence from residents, non-residents, and the federal government, and how they would share liability in any of these fiscal options. So slide 5, I want to make an important note here, and this relates to Representative Sadler's question just a second ago, is that what I'm going to walk you through here is just a portion of the methodology that we applied to arrive at the results in the previous slide. Our more complete analysis considers how federal income taxes would interact with these various tax options, but that as I'm sure that we're all aware, having done our federal income taxes, are complicated, and I want to set that issue aside for the purposes of this presentation. And so what we'll be discussing is how these calculations were conducted on a free federal tax basis. But just have in the back of your head so that there's another calculation that we apply after the fact to calculate how federal income taxes play an additional role here. On slide six, we describe the basic methodology for estimating the income tax base in our analysis. So I mentioned that that this study was a part of an attempt to update and expand an analysis that ICER conducted in 2016. And so a significant portion of the methodology that we applied in this analysis was adopted from that 2016 study, including how they approached estimating the state income tax base. So as in 2016, what we do is we start with income information from what's called the Public Use Microdata Sample, or the PUM sample, of the American Community Survey, or the ACS, which is a survey that's administered by the U.S. Census Bureau for the purposes of understanding the demographics and economic situations of households across the country. The survey asks a number of questions about households, the homes that they live in, the jobs that they do, their family structure, etc. For the purposes of our analysis, we use what's called the one-year file from the most recent year of data in 2023. 1 year just means that it's a single year in the sample period. So there's also 3 and 5 year files that are available from the ACS. We're using the one year vintage for our analysis. The ACS uses a sample frame. So the universe of potential households in Alaska that they can sample from are drawn from what's called the master address file in Alaska. And so your ability to receive this survey and participate in it is dependent on you having an address somewhere in the state of Alaska. The U.S. Census has to make a number of adjustments here to account for Alaska's unique situation, remote communities, et cetera. But suffice it to say that those that have some type of mailing address in the state of Alaska are the universe that could potentially be sampled for the ACS. The 2023 PUM sample contained roughly 6,900 Alaska households that are used for the purposes of our analysis. And so what we can do with those 6,900 households is using the sample weights from the survey, the weights that allow us to scale a sample up to the population, is understand what the complete distribution is of household income in the state of Alaska for those that are covered by the American Community Survey. The next step of the analysis we describe on slide 7, which is now we need an understanding of non-resident wages and incomes. So the PUM sample gives us an understanding of what Alaska resident incomes looks like, but now we need an understanding of what non-resident wages and income look like. And those data, I think, were usefully described by the previous presenter, Mr. Robinson, as they come from the Alaska Department of Labor non-resident workers report. I believe Mr. Robinson was presenting the 2024 vintage of that analysis so that we can form in our work to the ACS file that we're using in 2023. We're going to use the previous vintage, 2023. As Mr. Robinson noted, the non-resident worker share has increased since 2023, but we wanted a consistent unit of analysis in our study. And so maybe make a mental adjustment for yourselves kind of directionally in what's changed since the previous year of data. Alaska Department of Labor reports non-resident wages by industry, so that's the key input data here to understand the distribution of non-resident wages. That distribution is very important to understand the how the progressive income tax versus the flat income tax might differ in thinking about the what burden might fall on non-resident workers. As Mr. Robinson noted in his testimony, residency definitions from the Alaska Department of Labor are based on permanent fund dividend received. But note that that definition is different than the definition that the American Community Survey uses for its residency definitions. And so this is a new piece of analysis that we did as part of this update to the 2016 study. As Mr. Robinson noted, the Department of Labor quantifies the number of non-resident workers that become resident workers in a given year, and they do that classification by industry. And so we are able to separately estimate this distribution of income for these workers that are converting from non-residents to residents in a given year. So that's an important way in which we reconcile the way that the Department of Labor thinks about non-residents and the way that the American Community Survey thinks about non-residents. So we're using a reconciled definition of residency.
Mr. Watson, we have a question from Representative Sadler.
Thank you, through the chair, Mr. Watson. Dr. Watson, I'm sorry, could you again explain the definition of what a converter is? Are you saying it's industry by industry? You've got some kind of a factor that shows where non-residents really are residents? Just define converter, what that process is, please.
Absolutely, Representative Sadler, through the chair. So what we're trying to reconcile is my colleague Brock Wilson, who's an economist here at ICER, has now lived and worked in the state of Alaska for 2 years. But given his timing of arrival in the state of Alaska, he has not yet received his first permanent fund dividend. But if he were to receive a survey from the U.S. Census Bureau, he would say that he was an Alaska resident. And so for anyone that lives and works in the state of Alaska that falls under the classification, like my colleague Dr. Wilson, we want to make sure that they are fully reconciled such that we're comparing apples to apples, residents to residents. And so the Department of Labor indeed does track people that previously did not receive a permanent fund dividend in 1 year and then did in the following year, which, hopefully that will be the situation for my colleague, Dr. Wilson, when he applies for his dividend this year and receives it this October.
Very good follow-up. And that makes more sense. And if I could, I see AKDOL, which I assume is Alaska Department of Labor. Then I see DOL, Department of Labor. I've always used DOLWD for the state labor department, and DOL is the federal. So I just want to clarify that both abbreviations refer to the state of Alaska's Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Otherwise, I was thinking there might be some federal converter formula that we were applying.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, this is an omission on my part. I should have used AKDOLWD in both locations.
Easy to clarify. Thank you, Mitchell.
Please proceed, Dr. Watson.
And then finally, on the next slide, slide 8, we have to make a final assumption. And this is potentially the assumption that requires the biggest stretch for us, which is that as in 2016, we assume that the distribution of resident and non-resident non-wage income is proportional to their wage income. And so what I mean by this is that because we don't observe the non-wage income that non-residents of the state of Alaska are potentially earning in the state of Alaska, and here we're thinking about income like income related to the ownership of a small business, an LLC, a proprietorship, maybe someone, a doctor that's in private practice that's a non-resident, we need to identify a resident that's similarly situated in terms of their wage income and assume that that non-wage income is earned proportionally to that wage income. This is an assumption that was made in the 2016 study, and for the sake of consistency in our report, we adopted it here. It's also just very difficult given the limited data on non-wage earnings for non-residents to understand exactly what that distribution might look like, but an important limitation of our analysis.
Thank you, Mr. Watson. We have another question from Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I understand the desire of economists to make sure and account for whatever variables you can and define your terms. But my question is this: does the potential for a disparity between the non-resident and resident non-wage income, is that likely to have any kind of significant impact on the resulting analysis? Or is that just a small factor you're trying to kind of clear up?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, so this is something that we tried to understand what might be the exact magnitude of. So yeah. One way to think about the potential magnitude here is to look at resident non-wage and salary income. So if you look at total income earned by Alaska residents that were reported as part of adjusted gross income to the IRS last year, it was something to the tune of about $30 billion. So that's total income, the total adjusted gross income, $30 billion. $20 billion of that was wage and salary income, reported as AGI. And so that means $10 billion, or a third of AGI, was non-wage income. So that's how large that proportion is for Alaska residents, about a third. The largest portions of that are related to retirement income. This is pensions, Social Security payments, annuity payments, et cetera. That accounts for 15 to 20% of that non-wage income for Alaska residents. The The share that would likely be subject to any type of income tax, whether it be a progressive tax or a flat income tax, would likely be focused on that pass-through income to businesses, potentially, or the portion of non-resident income that might be subject to such a tax, whether it be progressive or flat, is likely through business-related income. And I'm not sure if there's a way for us to understand directionally whether or not non-residents or residents might have a larger share of that business-related income. So I wouldn't be able to hypothesize which direction I would expect that to go, whether residents or non-residents had a larger share of business-related pass-through income in the state.
Follow up.
And I guess I'm surprised through the chair to see how significant a portion of the total state resident income is non-wage. And I was kind of looking for probing for some kind of operation of business or ownership or that might account for a significant enough change to consider. But okay, I think you've answered my question. You don't know exactly.
Well, Representative Sadler, through the chair, I would note that our share of non-wage and salary income in Alaska is almost identical to the national average of 65 or 66%. And so that's not anomalous here in the state. As I mentioned, the kind of bulk of that is retirement type income from Social Security payments or annuities or pensions, with the balance related to capital gains, dividends, rents, and interest. And then this business type income represents a relatively small share.
Great. Cool. Thanks.
Please proceed, Mr. Watson.
So on slide 9, I'm sharing data in a slightly different way than Mr. Robinson did with his presentation of the distribution of resident and non-resident wages. And so what you can see here in these two bars, the green colored bars are non-resident wages, and the gray colored bars are resident wages. So the same colors that I used in the previous slide to describe the relative incidence of the various fiscal options. Each of these pairs of bars across this figure represents an industry. If you go to slide 10, I make that note that each bar is associated with a particular industry. And industries in the state are organized from the left-hand side of this figure for those industries with the smallest wages, average wages. And on the right-hand side of the figure are those industries with the highest average wages. If you go to the next slide, slide 11, I've noted here that as Mr. Robinson mentioned in his presentation, the industry with the single highest average for wages is the oil and gas extraction industry, where an average worker will earn $235,000 a year. In their 2023 report, DOL identified 2,300 resident workers in that industry and 917 non-resident workers. If you go to the next slide, slide 12, this is basically the computation, where we walk through the computation of resident, non-resident wages and how we do this conversion of PFD non-residents to the ACF's definition of non-residents. So each of these rows represents a income bracket, a wage income bracket. And so you can see that the rows are organized here from those workers that are earning the lowest wages at the top, those workers in industries that are earning the highest wages toward the bottom of the slide. And then the columns are organized to walk you through the calculation. So the Department of Labor and Workforce Development identifies PFD non-resident workers, as Mr. Robinson noted, as earning about $3.5 billion in wage income in 2023. That's denoted in the total line at the bottom of this slide. But there's a portion of those workers that then became Alaska residents within the next year. Those workers across the various industries where they worked earned about $360 million in 2023. And so we can reconcile this PFD definition of residency with the ACS definition of residency, which is just individuals who've lived in Alaska for a year or so, and not a calendar year. To estimate that non-residents, according to the ACS definition, probably earned about $3.2 billion in wages, while Alaska residents, under the ACS definition, probably earned $17 billion in wage income in 2023. So this table just walks you through, again, this reconciliation calculation, change or converting these PFD non-residents to ACS definitions of non-residency, and then comparing that to the ACS definition of residency after we've made the same reconciliation.
Thank you, Dr. Watson. With the interest of time, my understanding is that you have approximately 7 or 8 more slides, and so with that understanding, we have about 10 minutes left of the committee's time. I'd like to hold all questions until the end of your presentation.
Okay, yeah, that's not a problem. And I'll try to be brief with these next few slides. On the next slide, slide 13, I'll walk you through the methodology for calculating the base of the sales tax. So in our analysis, we estimate two different sales tax bases, one that would be broader and exclude fewer categories. The particularly exclusions that we take out of the base are shelter, healthcare, and education-related expenditures. And then we estimate a more narrow sales tax base that would exclude even more items, which would include all of the above exclusions, plus utilities and food at home. So what we do to calculate a hypothetical sales tax base in Alaska is we start with a product called the Personal Consumption Expenditures Dataset from the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis, or the BEA. A couple of important concepts from PCE to note here is that PCE is an attempt to measure household and nonprofit final out-of-pocket consumption expenditures. And so PCE is not designed to measure what you might call business-to-business transactions, which might be included in a hypothetical sales tax proposal, but was not specifically modeled as part of our analysis. Our sales tax models consider final out-of-pocket consumption expenditures in the two sales tax bases that I noted previously. In addition, PCE includes many imputed or non-market transactions. And what I mean by imputed or non-market transactions, for example, is a category like shelter, where many Alaskans own their homes outright, but the Bureau of Economic Analysis will compute something called owner-occupied implied rents or implied rental income, which is basically just a measure of how much value do households get from occupying their homes, and they quantify that as a form of consumption. They do something similar with healthcare, where there's not actually a financial transaction made between an employee and employer. Employers are picking up a portion of their health expenditures on the part of their employees, but the Bureau of Economic Analysis measures that as part of a household's expenditures. Secondly, an important concept from PCE is that it's based on the residency of the households, not a point of sale. The PCE in general measures what Alaskans buy regardless of where they buy it. And so we need to make a couple of adjustments to PCE in light of these concepts, which I describe in slide 14. So the first change that we need to make is to subtract from PCE all of these imputed categories of non-market transactions, which would be not subject to a hypothetical sales tax. These were also assumed to be outside the sales tax base in the ICER 2016 study, and so this is another assumption that we're copying over. The next adjustment that we need to make is to subtract any foreign travel that Alaskans engage in. So this is travel outside the United States, which obviously would be outside the scope of an Alaska-based sales tax. And then we need to make two additions to personal consumption expenditures. We need to add an estimate of non-resident worker expenditures. Those non-resident workers that Mr. Robinson described in his presentation potentially spend money in the Alaska economy that would be subject to a hypothetical sales tax. And we need to add direct visitor expenditures. When visitors visit the state of Alaska, their purchases could be potentially subject to a sales tax as well. So we need to add those two additional categories. On slide 15, I walk you through the adjustments that we made to the top line personal consumption expenditures for the state of Alaska in the year 2024. In that year, PCE expenditures in Alaska were just under $50 billion. We make a few adjustments that I noted previously to these non-monetary transactions and foreign travel, which reduce PCE to just over $46 billion. We subtract these non-market transactions in shelter, healthcare, and education, which amount to about $19 billion. And that leaves us with a broad sales tax base after those exclusions of about $27 billion. And if we exempt from that base an additional category of expenditures for utilities and food at home, we arrive at a more narrow base of $23 billion. So that's how we arrived at how much Alaska residents might contribute to a tax sales tax base in both a broad and narrow form. On slide 16, I walk through our calculations for how we calculated non-resident worker expenditures in the state. So unfortunately, we don't have any data on what non-workers spend when they are working in the state of Alaska. And so what we do is a pretty simple scaling exercise. We look at the wages that were earned by non-residents working in the state of Alaska, as I discussed in our section on our income tax methodology. And then we just make a couple of simplifying assumptions here. We construct two different scenarios, a more extreme scenario, where we assume that non-resident workers spend none of their income in Alaska, and so none of that income would be subject to taxes when Alaska or non-residents make purchases here. And on the other extreme, we assume that non-resident workers spend their income in Alaska exactly like Alaska residents do, meaning that they spend and they save in the same proportions as Alaska residents, scaled to the level of income that they receive. And then finally, we construct a bit of a Goldilocks scenario where non-resident workers are doing something in between, and they spend 25% of their discretionary income in Alaska. As Mr. Robinson noted, many non-resident workers in Alaska only work in the state for a single quarter, and so that's where this 25% number comes from. But note that this scenario exists in between the two bounds of the more extreme scenarios outlined previously. Slide 17 describes the calculation for visitor expenditures. The Alaska Travel Industry Association in 2024 estimated $4.5 billion in direct visitor expenditures in the state of Alaska. That comes from two sources of information that they combined together for that estimate. A report that was commissioned by ATIA from Destination Analytics Alaska, and a long-running survey that is compiled by McKinley Research Group to construct visitor counts. So as ATIA does, we combine those two pieces of information, namely how much visitors spend on an average trip to the state of Alaska, depending on their modality that they arrive to the state by, knowing that cruise passengers tend to spend less in the Alaska economy than independent travelers do. And then we multiply those estimates by the number of visitors that arrive by that modality. For the most part, all of these visitor expenditures would be subject to taxes on or both a broad construction of a sales tax base and a more narrow base, with one exception, which is this category of food at home. And so some travelers are likely to arrive in the state of Alaska, potentially as independent travelers, and purchase groceries or beverages from grocery stores or other beverage distributors. And exceptions for those categories of expenditures from a sales tax might exclude their consumption of these goods from that tax base. So we assume a certain fraction of independent travelers and cross-Gulf cruise passengers would spend their total food and dining budgets on this food at home category and exclude that from the sales tax base of the narrow sales tax. Slide 18 shows how we combine these three sources of information together, namely our resident sales tax base, our non-resident worker sales tax base, and our visitor tax base, to get at the incidence that Alaska residents would experience under a broad and more narrow sales tax. On the far right-hand side of this table, you can see those three scenarios that I mentioned constructing for non-worker expenditures. A base case where they expend 25% of their total income here in the state of Alaska, the low case where they expend none of their own, none of their wages in the state, and then a high scenario where they would consume just like an Alaska resident would. And you can see that that moves the needle from our base case of 82% Alaska resident incidents. Residents would experience a higher burden if non-resident workers didn't spend any of their money here at 84%, and would experience less of a burden if non-resident workers spent a lot of their income here at 77%. But you can see that band exists in about a 7% range, plus or minus. The final slide, slide 19, just provides some limitations or further considerations. As I mentioned to Representative Sadler earlier in response to his question, non-resident both income and expenditures are difficult to measure with precision, so we construct two scenarios for extremes with respect to non-resident workers, and then for non-resident income, their income is unobservable. Their non-wage income is unobservable and difficult to even bound. It's also important to note that the specific design of tax policy will have important implications for the tax base. Income taxes, for example, thinking about which categories of wage and salary income would be excluded. So, for example, exemptions for Social Security income, for example, might change the relative incidence between residents and non-residents. Thinking about a sales tax base, thinking about exactly which goods or services would be subject to a tax would also adjust the relative incidence. I think it's also important to note that we assume 100% compliance in our analysis, meaning that any income or expenditures that were part of the estimated base would be assumed to be collected by the tax for residents and non-residents, but it certainly could be the case that non-compliance could affect that relative share. So I'll stop there, knowing that I'm a few minutes over time, and want to thank you for your attention this afternoon.
Thank you very much, Mr. Watson. I believe we have just one question, and that is from Co-Chair Fields.
Yeah, through the chair, really just a comment. I think the 25%, if you want to look at that one, probably grossly overstates what non-residents spend in Alaska a year. You know, your high-income workers, your oil and metal mine workers spend essentially zero here. They fly in, fly out. They're fed in a man camp. They spend nothing. And then among your low-wage workers, which in aggregate are, you know, a significant share of income, obviously most of them are saving money and taking it home, and that's particularly true of seafood. So I would just have to think, since taken together, that's the bulk of the income, it would be far, far less than 25% being spent, and therefore would affect your sales tax calculations.
Yeah, Co-Chair Fields, through the co-chair, I agree, yes, that, again, given the uncertainty with exactly what non-resident expenditures might be, we constructed that extreme case where none of their income was expended in the state of Alaska. Again, I think that probably represents the lower bound for what non-resident non-resident incidence could be. And you can see how that moves the needle in slide 18 from 82% in the base case for resident burden to 84% resident burden in that extreme case.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Watson. We really appreciate your time and your presentation. And thanks again to Dan Robinson from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. This concludes the presentation on non-resident workers in Alaska. Seeing no further business before the committee, that concludes our business for today. The House Labor and Commerce Committee will meet next on Wednesday, February 18th. This meeting is adjourned at 5:18 p.m.